Hello, I'm Annie Corrigan, and this is Earth Eats.
You know, there's a certain stewardship that I think farmers have of the land, and they want to see that land nurtured and continue.
That's documentary filmmaker Chuck Schultz. His film, The Last Crop, tells the story of a California farming family that wants to do more than just preserve their land. They want to dictate how the farm is run for generations to come. There's a movement to revive the traditions of growing and eating indigenous foods. That's from Harvest Public Media. We'll also hear what impact it has on families when kids age out of a certain type of food assistance. And in the kitchen, we're glad to be back with Chef Arlen Llewellyn. She preps a roasted tomato dressing for a big bowl of greens. For news, we turn to Mark Chilla.
A little good news, bad news to start off this week's update. New research shows that climate change and higher levels of carbon dioxide in the air has spurred more plant growth around the world. Since plants absorb CO2, researchers say that has caused a decrease in annual carbon emissions from 50% to 40% over the last 10 years. Unfortunately, that trend is not nearly enough to offset carbon emissions from burning fossil fuels or deforestation. Authors of the study, which was published in the journal Nature Communications, used computer models, satellite data on plant density, and global CO2 measurements to determine the levels of greening around the world. They found that from 2002 to 2014, the rate that CO2 increases in the atmosphere leveled off. Previously, that rate increased along with the increase of greenhouse gas emissions, but the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere still continues to rise to record levels, and plants can't do enough to reverse the runaway effects of climate change. While the economy has improved marginally in rural areas since the Great Recession, cities continue to do better. The rural employment rate still has not returned to its pre-2008 level, and economic growth has been slow. That's according to a new Department of Agriculture report. In the last few years, rural areas have also seen their populations decline. USDA Chief Tom Vilsack said the rural unemployment rate is improving, and said in a statement that the new data shows rural America is poised for a, quote, remarkable comeback. And our blogger Taylor Killo did some digging this week to try to predict what we could expect in ag policies from the Trump administration. A copy of a document detailing Trump's Ag Advisory Committee talking points, obtained by Politico, suggests a shift back to conventional agriculture and deregulation under the new administration. As for Trump's picks for ag secretary, it's being described as a who's who of farm policy, many of them former leaders in farm states. Taylor compiled a list of possible appointees with brief bios. It's at eartheats.org. You can also see food and farming headlines as soon as we do on Twitter. Connect with us on Twitter at EarthEats.
Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killo for these stories. Thanks also to Mark Chilla. Many low-income families struggle to afford enough food. Moms and kids who qualify can participate in a federal program geared toward early development. Once kids turn five, though, they are no longer eligible for the benefits. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports on how that puts families at risk.
Now it's getting loud.
It's 7:30 in the morning at Battle Elementary School in Columbia, Missouri. Students hop off of their buses and head down the hallway past a few folding tables with crates of milk, juice, fruit, and warm muffins sitting on top. Lena Fulham is the director of nutrition services for the Columbia Public School District. Here, it's not just the low-income students who pick up a free breakfast on the way to class.
It's for all students, which takes the stigma away from students eating with us. So everybody's doing it, so it's just the natural thing to do at the beginning of the day.
For low-income families, putting nutritious meals on the table can be challenging. Nationally, schools served 1.8 billion free breakfasts in 2015, and even more free or cheap lunches. Even with free meals at school, courtesy of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Fulham says she knows many of these students are still hungry at home.
The one thing we do notice is that students eat a lot on Monday and eat a lot on Friday because a few of them, when they go home, know there's not going to be much there.
So what about the kids who aren't in school yet? That's what the WIC program is for. It's called Women, Infants, and Children, and it provides food and other benefits to some 8 million moms and young kids nationwide.
At that time, if I didn't have it, it would mean my kids not having enough during the day to eat.
Chantel Dos Remedios was pregnant with her second child when she and her husband both lost their jobs. She depended on WIC for the extra help.
It was such a great help when you have nothing coming in until you can get back on your feet again.
But the WIC program only provides benefits to children under five. When Dos Remedios' first son turned five, he still hadn't started kindergarten, so he couldn't take advantage of free school meals. That donut hole, the gap between aging out of WIC and starting school, hits lots of families, Dos Remedios says, and she wishes that gap was bridged.
I believe that would help a lot of parents because it is an additional cost for a whole year providing the extra food until they can get into a full-day kindergarten or a full-day school.
Our research showed that there's a spike in food insecurity right around this age point when children lose eligibility for WIC.
Colleen Heflin specializes in food policy as a professor at the University of Missouri. She recently published new research looking at kids who fall into this gap. She found that losing a food package for one child can plunge the whole family into an unstable situation without enough food. When a family of five has to split four meals, no one gets enough to eat. And she says a lack of nutritious food can have lasting effects on the kids.
There are physical effects, mental health effects, cognitive effects. We know there's differences in family functioning, and even somewhat obvious things like families are less likely to eat meals together, which we know has impacts on all sorts of positive pro-social behaviors.
When children fall into this gap, the families sometimes enroll in SNAP or food stamps, while others shop at the food bank. So here's the idea. Extend WIC eligibility to age six.
And this would, for most of the children in our sample, close that gap entirely.
There's a bill sitting in the U.S. Senate right now that does just that, raises the age cutoff. Douglas Greenaway is president of the National WIC Association, which advocates for low-income families.
We ought to be doing everything we can to facilitate ease of access and reducing those barriers. So, let's streamline access to the program.
But in 2015, the program cost about $6.2 billion. Extending eligibility would likely increase the price, which means changing who qualifies for WIC is an uphill battle. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
This story and plenty of others from the team at Harvest on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. It was 2008, and Chuck Schultz was trying to plan his next move. He's a documentary filmmaker, and he'd just finished up movies in New Jersey and Alabama. So he got in touch with a couple old friends who lived in a very beautiful part of California near Sacramento.
And my friends, who actually are Annie and Jeff Main, the central characters in our film, CSA members, said, "Hey, you should read Annie and Jeff's newsletter. They're great. You could get to know them a little bit, but you should come out here and look for a story." And I thought, well, okay, I'll look, and if I can find something that I think's interesting, well, maybe I did find a place I wanted to spend the next 4 or 5 years, maybe, not knowing that it would be eight.
That's how he started work on The Last Crop, a documentary about the farm Good Humus Produce and farmers Jeff and Annie Main. The Mains started working this 20-acre organic farm in 1976. They have three children, Zach, Allison, and Claire, none of whom have committed to taking over the farm when their parents retire. Schultz spent 8 years filming Jeff and Annie, working with their local land trust to write a conservation easement that would protect the farm for generations. He visited Earth Eats earlier this month. So the story starts out like we've heard it. Farmers are aging. Who's going to take over for them? How are we going to feed all these people? But then your story takes a turn when Jeff and Annie are trying to find a way to not just conserve their land and their farm, but their way of life. And here's where they get into a bit of a struggle with the land trust that they're trying to work with. Can you describe how their situation and their conservation efforts are different?
I mean, I think it's important that people realize that when you the human element here in conservation has sort of been missing. It's habitat that we want to visit, but it's not we're not at this particular moment in time supporting farms and the farmers who are on that land or who want to be on that land, and to preserve those working farms into perpetuity, at least if they can. So Annie's and Jeff's easement requires many restrictions. Whoever they're going to sell their easement to will only have the right to live there and the right to farm. And they need to make approximately 50% of their income, so it's an active farm. The farmers, in return, only pay the ag value for the property versus the market value for the property. And at the end, they can only sell it to the next farmer at its agricultural value.
You were part of this. So can you describe why the land trust had such a problem with this?
Well, the land trust's biggest problem, I think within the land trust board, it was discussed heatedly about whether or not they should or shouldn't take this easement on. Ultimately, the land trust decided not to. The big issue is that there's no legal precedent in California for this type of easement. Again, conservation easements protecting land, but not really ensuring that it's actually going to be farmed and there's going to be a farmer living on it and working the land. That's a new wrinkle, a new development. And so Annie and Jeff's easement is a model. And the land trust, I think in the end, what I've learned is that they're not so much worried about Annie's succession with the next generation of farmer. It's the third or fourth generation of this transition where someone from the outside with money could question whether or not they shouldn't be able to purchase the land. That's when there could be a severe financial cost to the land trust to enforce the easement, because if someone comes on the land, if they can't live up to the restrictions and agreement of the conservation easement, the land trust then has the option to purchase the land back at its agricultural value and have another farmer take over the land. Mm-hmm. So that's it's a big chunk to take on, although I think there's lots of land trusts in California that are waiting for one of these someone to make this happen.
So that's the business side of the story. But the heart of your movie really, to me, feels like a conflict between one generation and the next. You got on tape, probably the emotional climax of the film is in the kitchen. No one was really looking at each other. The kids are not speaking, and Annie and Jeff are, saying, all right, here's the moment. What are we going to do about this farm? We need to talk about this easement. What was it like to be there for that?
Jeff had said he wanted to have this meeting. And I said, Jeff, if you're going to have this meeting with your children, then I have to shoot it. I mean, that's an important moment in the film. And I've had other farmers, children of farmers say, wow, you got in there and you actually got this conversation. And this is a hard one to get. It was sort of spare the moment, but I think we captured the parents' need for the children to actually at least think about it. I mean, there's always pressure for a child. Any business, family business, there's pressure. This one, if you're a graphic arts major or you're a fireman or you're a communications major, that's a big step to come back to the land. So as far as their children go, Annie and Jeff would like nothing more than have their children succeed them. But the realities are there's lots of choices, and they support their children's idea to do something else. So as difficult as it is for the kids and for them, the children realize that their parents have actually built this farm from the ground up. It's a first-generation farm.
We are hearing stories. We've aired stories about people, young people going off, having a career, and then knowing that they have this land, and so they come back to it and rejoin farming on their family land. Do you see that happening with the Maine children?
I actually do. They all love the land. They're all circling the farm, but no one's really made the commitment yet, because it's a big commitment to farm. It truly is. And I think, Annie and Jeff have no immediate plans to retire. I think Annie might be ready more than Jeff. And Jeff loves what he does, but he also knows that he's now in his mid-60s and farming is getting more difficult physically for him. I think he loves the work.
You're a filmmaker. Are you also an advocate for this farm and this easement?
Well, I'd say yes, I certainly am. I mean, look, as a documentarian, you either want to make a film because you want to maybe tear someone down or some issue down or expose some issue that you think is important for people to know, or else you really find a character or a story that you really want to share with people, and you're really hoping for, you know, you're in their corner. I mean, I was in their corner. What I can do is make a film that can hopefully be shown in communities around the country, where after the film's over, we can talk about the film for a few minutes, but then hopefully the conversation's going to revolve around what's happening in your particular community regarding farmland preservation and succession, and how can you actually support your local farmers.
Chuck Schultz is the director and co-producer of The Last Crop. The Maines are proposing their easement to other land trusts in California, so this story is not finished yet. Keep up with what's happening at thelastcropfilm.com. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location available at whereisurgent.com. We said goodbye to tomato season in southern Indiana weeks ago, but maybe you put some Roma tomatoes in the freezer like I did. I use them for chilies and sauces all throughout the winter. And then there's this way to use tomatoes.
The nice thing about this recipe is these tomatoes do not have to be that good looking because you're going to be cooking these. So we're just going to come along and core the tomatoes first.
In Chef Arlen Llewellyn's kitchen, these tomatoes are from Graber Produce, and she's whipping up a roasted tomato vinaigrette.
So this is my favorite part of the recipe. We get to play with our food. We have the slices of tomatoes, and we want to get rid of all this extra moisture because we're going to be roasting these, and we really want to bring out the intense flavor of the tomato. So we get to come along with our fingers and just sort of squish out the squishy bits, the seeds and the pulp. Squish. We toss this with a quarter cup of oil, olive oil, and 1 teaspoon of salt. Just get it nicely distributed. And then we spread it out on a sheet pan with parchment paper. And you roast them for quite a while. You're going to roast them at 300 degrees for about an hour, and then raise the oven temperature to 350 for a final half an hour. So it's, again, something you're going to want to plan for a little bit far in advance. These have roasted already, and you can see that they have a nice caramelized edge to them and that the flesh has decreased in volume because it's given up a lot of its moisture. So, adding to the blender, in addition to the tomatoes, we will add 2 garlic cloves, 1/4 cup of red wine vinegar, 2 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar.
And miso pesto.
Back to our trusty friend. We could certainly use salt if you don't have miso. It's just so dang tasty. I had a friend who gave me a white miso and peach jam that blew my mind. We had it with cheese and crackers, and I had never thought of miso outside the context of Asian cuisine, and I was just blown away at really how versatile it is. I mean, this soy sauce brings all this rich umami flavor, but to me, it's really difficult to separate it from Asian food. But miso has that same rich fermented soy flavor, but it's not, I don't know what it is about it, but it just, you can put it on a burger. Okay, that is it. So let's go ahead and get this blended up. Thank you. roasted tomato vinaigrette. Whew, that is so full of really intense, kind of rich flavor.
About the miso paste, Llewellyn made another dressing that day and some beet-pickled deviled eggs, and both of those recipes each had a healthy dollop of miso paste in there. So add miso paste to your shopping list today and then search for it at eartheats.org to see what recipes you can make. All right, the salad part of this recipe, after we hear from Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media. Long before European settlers plowed up the plains, corn was an important part of the diet of many Native American tribes. Today, indigenous crops are making a comeback. Some tribes are hoping to revive their food and farming traditions. Grant has the story.
Do you guys mind if I sing my song while I do some of this?
On a warm, bright September afternoon, Taylor Keene is singing to the corn.
Y'all know, oh, y'all know, hey, Nate. We are not, he are not, who we are not, and they away.
Keene wears a cowboy hat and Wranglers and a traditional bead necklace. We're behind his home in Omaha walking through his backyard. It's a maze of cornrows and a carpet of pumpkin vines.
Well, this is what was formerly known as my backyard and is now home to the Four Sisters. We have corn, bean, squash, and the sunflower.
They're called the Four Sisters because of how they work together. The beans climb and fertilize the corn, sunflowers hold them up against the wind, squash keep the raccoons at bay. There are tomatoes too, and okra, gourds, sage, and sweetgrass. Today the corn is ripe and ready to pick, but it's not your typical yellow corn. Keene raises varieties that were once common on the Great Plains. There's indigenous popcorn, there's flint corn that can be ground into cornmeal. Keene pulls down an ear that looks like sweet corn, but he uses it to make flour. It's called Cherokee White.
While it's predominantly white, we see these wonderful pastel purples and dark blues and goldens and even a pink or two in there.
Keene is a business instructor at Creighton University. He was never a corn grower, but his ancestors were, the Omaha tribe in Nebraska and the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma.
Corn, especially here in Nebraska, is synonymous with apple pie. But Indian corn is only ornamental and is sold only around Thanksgiving time. And most people don't even think it's edible, but where does corn come from? It comes from us.
Keene wants to reclaim those farming roots with a project called Sacred Seed. With help from students and some urban farmers in Omaha, he's raising indigenous crops on about a dozen plots around the city. The goal is to preserve these native vegetable varieties and revive the traditions around growing and eating them.
I totally think that that these items belong on menus.
Dan Watts is a chef at Spencer's, a high-end steakhouse in Omaha. He says most people have never tried preparing this kind of corn. But once you know what to do, Watts says this old corn fits in a modern kitchen.
Like, you can make a great cornbread with it, right? You can grind it down into polenta, grits, tortillas, and the nutrient load is massive.
Watts says indigenous ingredients also fit in with the trendy local food scene. Some varieties are sold by heirloom seed dealers like Seed Savers in Iowa or Baker Creek Seeds in Missouri. But Sacred Seed also taps into a growing movement in Indian country called food sovereignty, a movement where food traditions mix with identity politics.
This is a movement to really reclaim agriculture at a local scale.
Robin Kimmerer is an ecologist and writer and a member of the Potawatomi Nation.
It's political because it resists industrial agriculture. It says there is another way.
Planting indigenous seeds instead of high-tech hybrids can reintroduce vegetables that have mostly been lost. She says projects like Native Harvest, started by the Ojibwe in Minnesota, or the Cherokee Seed Exchange, value tradition more than technology.
People are really taking control of their own food supplies by growing their traditional varieties, by learning again to collect and gather from the wild.
Beautiful air.
Taylor Keene says in the 19th century, the Omaha were prolific corn growers and traders. And while indigenous corn is not going to overtake the industry that feeds ethanol plants and cattle feedlots, it might provide a few jobs for tribal members.
In my mind, I envisioned a future where everyone in my tribe could be corn planters again, that somehow we could sustain ourselves, economically self-reliant again with these crops.
Keene believes looking to that past is one way to help his people move forward. I'm Grant Gerlach.
There's a video of this too, so you can see all the vibrant colors of corn coming out of Taylor Keene's garden. Watch it at harvestpublicmedia.org. Back at the prep station with Arlen Llewellyn. Remember her gasp of surprise when she tasted the dressing? Well, that was genuine. We don't often enjoy salad dressing just on its own, so she's assembled a pack of greens to stand up to all that flavor.
But this is a really bright, sharp dressing, and so you can have a really strong green underneath it, and they will complement each other very well. If you were to put that dressing on iceberg, for instance, it would just kind of be overwhelming. You kind of want a green that can hold its own. So we've got some Savoy cabbage.
This is from Living Roots Eco Village.
And there's dirt in there because it was grown on an actual farm, ladies and gentlemen.
We're gonna wash that in just a second, but it's always kind of nice. What I also like is when you find a live bug in it, because to me that means it wasn't treated with some sort of harsh pesticide. The bug was able to live. Stubborn grit here.
And some radishes from Rising Moon Acres.
Radishes are definitely usually a pretty dirty vegetable, and the farmers tend to present them to you in a pretty natural way with their greens still attached, and this means that you need to give it a quick rinse, but it also means that you've got radish tops if you want to do something with them.
Yeah, we could have thrown that in the salad too, right?
Yeah, we absolutely could. You could also make a great pesto with those. You could put them in a soup. Okay, so you could stop here, and it would be a totally vegan salad. You could top it with some crispy chickpeas, for instance. We're going to take it a step further and add a few other things to it.
Woo, blue cheese.
Not just blue cheese, it is smoked blue cheese.
Oh my God.
It's a great, I feel like, vegetarian substitute for bacon because you get this really nice, distinctive smoke flavor with that richness.
And then last but not least,
we've taken some very thinly sliced prosciutto and cooked it. I'll just tear it into some bite-sized pieces. I really appreciate the approach of eating where meat becomes, you know, a condiment or a garnish, and the main focus of this meal is vegetables. And I hope you enjoy.
A big thanks to Function Brewing and Arlen Llewellyn for this recipe. It's on our website with a picture of Arlen getting ready to dig into this dinner of a salad. Find it at eartheats.org. The beautiful pictures that go with many of our recipes are courtesy of Aabon Binder, our photographer and web guy. Thanks, Aabon. Thanks also to Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, and Taylor Killo for keeping us informed. And Daniel Orr is our main man in the kitchen. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Next time we see each other, Thanksgiving will be over. We'll help you cope with all the leftovers. I'm Annie Corrigan. See ya.